And floor is yours, Amin. Welcome.
Thank you, Hedy. Good morning, everyone. Oh, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, I hope you are all well. So today, well, my name is Amin, and like Hedy said, I research on issues of race, racism, and anti-racism, specifically from the point of view of education. And today, I just want to talk about this lecture is about giving you kind of an introductory discussions or discourse about issues of anti-racism education. And I'll start by looking at the concept of race and then discuss why it is central to focus on that we always talk about race. So we it's central to look at the concept of race and move from the concept of race to the concept of racism, and from there dive into anti-racism. Just to remind you that we will not be covering everything when it comes to anti-racism. So we're going to touch on some topics and just leave them. And we will perhaps go detailly on, if you have questions and you want us to open some issues, you can bring that up at the end. But please feel free to stop interrupting me with questions at any point in time. So, race. Very often, when the word race comes up, a lot of people look very uncomfortable. But there is no way we can talk about racism without talking about race, because race precedes racism. However, what happens every single time, every single day, it happens to all of us. We are always talking about race without talking about race. Even when we think we're not talking about race, we are engaged in race discussions, consciously or unconsciously. Yet, very often we think that race is something of the past. Now, what is race? Race is a social construct, which means that I was born into a race. I was born into a race called the black race. There is nothing I can do about belonging to that black race. That's why I said it's a social construct. If I decide that I do not want to belong to that black race, and I maybe go to a tattoo parlor and put a tattoo on my head that says, I am white, because I self-identify as white doesn't mean that I would belong to a white race. Because the society in which I live in has already ascribed a particular race to me. I fit physically to the group that is identified as black. So that's why we say race is a social construct. It has nothing to do with biology, but it is about how we perceive human beings. In what boxes are we placed? I have been placed into a box that's called the black box. Whether I like it or not, that's my box, you know. And the reason why I'm placed into that box is because race itself is a power construct. There was a lot that happened in terms of coming up with the idea of race. For example, people always talk about, there was this question that people always ask, that the egg and the hen, which one came first? Now, if we relate that to the issue of race, one thing we have to understand is that before the idea of race came about, the characteristics that actually qualify people to a particular race had already been existing. But what happened with race, or with the idea or the politics of race, is that specific individuals based on a physical appearance were ascribed certain race and specific attributes. Now, this is why we say race is a power construct, because it then plays with who has a power. Based on this particular box that you're put into, what power do you have? How can you easily assess the world? Now, Whaley actually describes race in a very, I like his definition of race. He describes race as a set of sociopolitical processes that disciplines humanity into full humans, not quite humans, and non-humans. So within these specific boxes, we have been given specific attributes, which are then which then determine how the world sees us, determine how we are seen in the world. So our ways plays a huge importance in our lives, no matter where you are. I was born in Cameroon. Before I came to Finland, I knew I was black. In Cameroon, I already knew about what it meant to be black. But I really came to understand what it meant to be black when I was placed with non-black people. So we are all raised human beings. We are all raised people. And although in Finland, we don't collect data on race, and we don't Finland play down the issue of race, we have to understand that one of the most important concepts in terms of Western progress has been race. Because the West has used the concept of race to colonize the world, to commit genocide, and to enslave the world. So we cannot just ignore it, because it has played a huge part in terms of who we are, what we are, and what we can be. So race is a very, very important concept when we're looking at the concept of the topic of anti-racism or racism. And there is no way to talk about race without talking about the concept of white supremacy. And what we talk about, when we really describe race as sort of a political process that disciplines humanity. Now, the process of discipline white supremacy is actually the disciplinarian in terms of the concept of race. So we are all disciplined into our race because of the concept of white discipline of white supremacy. So very often when I talk about white supremacy, people always say, but we don't believe in that concept. We think people who are white supremacists are specific groups who identify as white supremacists. Now, for me, it is important that we understand white supremacy basically as the policing mechanism that puts us into our separate boxes. It keeps us in those separate boxes. So it helps the concept of race flourish. Now, the three most important things, three most important lessons that I want you to learn about the concept, or I want you to note when it comes to the concept of race. If you leave this lecture without understanding anything, take note of these three of this important lesson. One, it is about race if a person of color thinks it's about race. Now, it's also about race if it continuously or often, in different ways, affects a person or people of color. It's also about race if it fits into a broader pattern of events that affects a person or people of color. Now, let me give you an example so you can understand this better. Think about, just think of a character. Let's say there is a black Muslim veiled woman. She walks into a shop and says, let us say stock man. She walks to the shop at 2 o'clock. When she walks into the shop, she's trying to find a pair of shoes which her friends have told her that stockman has. So she walks through the aisles. At some point, she realizes that there's someone, a security officer, is following her. Everywhere she turns, she sees that security officer or the security guard. She gets pissed. She leaves the shop. She thinks, or she says, that incident is a race incident. It's a racist incident, that it had to do with the race, that this officer was following her because she's black, or maybe because she's a woman and she's Muslim and she's veiled. Now, remember, there are over two sides of every story. So let's listen to the security officer. Now, there is this particular security officer. He's white. He enjoys his work as a security officer, but he has routines. At the top of every hour, he leaves his post at the entrance of the shop and walks around the shop for 5 minutes. And then he stands at the outlet of the shop. So basically, if you walk another shop, you will then see him. He stands there for a few minutes and then walks back to the entrance. That's his routine. So on this day, at 2 p.m., this guy left his post at the entrance of the shop, walks through the aisles like he always does, and then goes and stands at the entrance. He doesn't even notice. He doesn't notice the lady at all. But the lady notices him. So to him, it's not about race. It's got nothing to do with race. But after hearing these two stories, we are forced to incline to support the Black lady or the Black Muslim veiled lady, because it's not about the intention of the person who is racializing. It's about the interpretation of the person who is being racialized. Now, this lady thinks it's about race because it fits into a broader pattern of events. Because we have to, one thing we have to note here is that no single racialized event can be understood as a single event. So you have to always think about what is the pattern here? And the pattern fits into the lady's narrative, because maybe not in Finland, but throughout the world, we've read books, we've seen stories where people of color, racialized people, Black people, are followed in the shops. So this fits into that narrative. So the lady is correct to think that this is an issue of race. Any questions so far? Okay, now let's move to racism. Kendi actually defines racism as racist policies plus racist ideas. So it's a combination of racist policies and racist ideas that produces and normalizes racial inequity. Now, racist policy basically means all kinds. Basically, what's a policy? A policy basically can be written or unwritten laws. A policy can be written or unwritten laws that guide a group of people. And for example, the Constitution is a policy. The documents that we use in schools are policies. They are policy documents. And so a racist policy basically is if that particular policy, whatever policy document that we have, if it sustains or if it produces racial inequity, then that policy basically is a racist policy. Now, a racist idea is basically any idea that any racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group. Basically, we all have racist ideas. But what makes my racist ideas, or what makes some people's racist idea non-problematic, is because they may not have the power of the policy to produce normalize racial inequity. Now, there are three key words to note whenever we're talking about racism. And these three key important words are racist, non-racist, and anti-racist. Now, when I did my PhD, I actually wrote in my PhD that the word racist is the worst word that has ever existed in the English language. Because then I understood racist as a permanent marker. So for example, when you engage in a conversation with someone and you describe a person as a racist, very often there is no redemption for that particular person. So as an educator, I was a little bit skeptical about using the word racist. But now I've learned to understand the word racist differently. So basically the word racist actually describes, it's a descriptive word. which describes someone's action at a given time. So if you are supporting a racist idea through your action or inaction, or you are supporting a racist policy or expressing a racist idea at a given time, that makes you a racist, which means that it's about moments. It's not about lifetime. Okay? Now, non-racist is those who take the middle ground. They say, well, we know racism is bad, but it's not my business. Someone else's business. And they choose not to involve. And this is, for me, is the most dangerous group of people, because they actually strengthen the narrative and the power of the racist. Because when you choose to take a non-racist stand, you are actually empowering those with power. Okay? Now, another racist is somebody who will support a racist idea or support a racist policy, or through their actions or inactions, or expresses an anti-racist idea. And I think one of the things we should always try to do is strive to become anti-racist. Now, we have to understand one thing about these three concepts. It's possible that you can be a racist at 2 p.m. You can be a non-racist at 1 minute after 2. You can be an anti-racist at 2 minutes after 2. So which means that it's about what you do at a given point in time. So we all have potential to be all of these things, but we should strive to be anti-racist. That's the goal here. Now, when I did my PhD, I actually argued that to understand racism in Finland, you have to be able to understand these four key concepts. Finnish exceptionalism, coloniality of power, denial of racism, and whiteness theory. That these are the theories that produces racism. So, and they are all interrelated. So, Finnish exceptionalism is the idea that we Finns are the best, and we are above anyone else. Because whenever there is the best, there's always a hierarchy where some other people are not that good. And there's a tendency that those who think themselves think of themselves as the best want to educate, help those at the bottom. And that can produce racism. Now, coloniality of power is basically the idea, it's kind of a continuation of idea of colonialism. That certain groups of people are not good enough to lead themselves, are not good enough to be humans. So for that reason, they have to be supported, they have to be taught, they have to be treated as not human enough, as inferior. And this kind of closely links to our idea of whiteness, where through the concept of coloniality, whiteness has been used to position specific groups of people, like white, as the most superior, and position other racial categories as inferior. And under this particular concept, I always like to say that we all possess qualities of whiteness. You know, for example, I often say I have friends. I have two of my, not really friends, they're colleagues of mine. One of them is French, and the other one is American. We all walk on the street. When we walk on the street, what happens is that we are all racialized equally. We are all viewed as those black guys. But then, when the French person speaks, he doesn't speak French, he speaks France. So through his speech, he attains whiteness. His experiences get better, so they treat him better because he speaks France, and France is white. So when the American speaks, he doesn't speak English, he speaks American. So through his speech, you can identify him as American, and he gets better treatment, less racism, because he can be identified as white. So we can attain white. So whiteness is not just about biology. There's more complexities within the whole concept of whiteness. And the concept that actually is the heartbeat of racism is the concept of denial of racism. Very often we are engaged in denial of racism because racism has been simplified. You know, we've simplified racism to basically racism is good or racism is bad. And knowing that racism is bad, that means if I know that racism is bad, then that means that I'm anti-racist. Which means that if I do things which can be identified as racist, that means I'm a bad person. And nobody wants to be a bad person. So for that reason, the first thing we do, consciously or unconsciously, is that whenever something comes up which has to do with issues of racism, that has to do with us, the first thing we do is to deny. Oh, I didn't mean that. But that's the word I meant. But that was not my intention. So our default response to issues of racism is denial. It's because we have simplified racism. I've simplified the whole concept of racist, non-racist, and anti-racist as a permanent descriptor, but not as a descriptive terms that actually define specific periods of our actions or inactions. Anti-racism. So basically, I define anti-racism basically as a political discourse and an intellectual practice of commitment that challenges racism at all levels. The reason why I think we have to look at anti-racism as a political discourse is because very often when we engage with issues of racism, we do not see racism as politics. We are uncomfortable to deal with the politics of racism because the politics of racism actually makes us look bad. Because basically, since we have actually minimized racism simplified racism to just good or bad, looking at the politics of racism means trying to find out, why does racism exist? How does it exist? Where does it exist? How am I implicated in this whole discussion of racism? What's my role in this? You know, so anti-racism basically forces us to look at the politics of racism and ask ourselves, how can we stop racism before it happens? And also when it happens, how can we prepare a world? How can we prepare this world to be an anti-racist world? How can we prepare our society to be an anti-racist society? And why I am very keen to talk about the importance of a specific society here is because the anti-racism that happens in Sweden is very different from the anti-racism that happens in Finland. Because every context has a unique, specific kind of anti-racism. So we have to kind of think about anti-racism based on the specific location and try to think and create different kinds of anti-racism methodologies. And so basically, during my research of race, racism and anti-racism in Finland, I came to discover there's been a lot of research that has shown that Finnish teachers are not good or not, they don't know how to respond to issues of racism in Finland. So when racism happens in school, very often they do one of these. First they say, oh, we didn't see it. I didn't hear it. Our hands are tight, but I don't really know what to do. This is a discrimination-free zone. There are just no plans to have to deal with these issues. And I think that blaming Finnish teachers for their inabilities to work on these issues is the wrong way to go. My recommendation in my PhD was that we need to kind of empower Finnish teachers. We need to give them the knowledge so that they can learn. We need to give them the knowledge that they would use because they are not taught on this topic. I can tell you that over 80% of Finnish teachers have never been to an anti-racism classroom, have never taken an anti-racism course, have never attended an anti-racism lecture, or have never read an anti-racism book. So how can you then expect them to be experts in handling these issues if you haven't trained them on these issues? So my recommendation was that we need to think about helping teachers by creating more anti-racism learning platforms for teachers in Finland. So they would learn to how to work with these issues. And here are some of the things I think that we need in Finland in terms of creating an anti-racism environment. So I think we need three key components. We need anti-racist teachers, we need anti-racist curriculums, and we need anti-racist policies. So basically, what's an anti-racist teacher? An anti-racist teacher or staff are teachers who understand the concept of anti-racism and are supporting anti-racist practice and policies through their action, through their teaching, in their schools and out of their schools. Okay. So we need to try to have more anti-racist conscious teachers, because through these teachers, we will then have a more anti-racist curriculum, which actually looks into theories and practice of racial inequalities and builds on new methodologies in terms of how we can do anti-racism in the school, in different classrooms, and at different levels of an educational environment. And with an anti-racist curriculum, we will then be forced to look into policies that guide our schools. We'll try to have policies which actually are that target racism, that are aimed at dismantling racism in a lot of schools. So we need to think about how to implement these three key points in terms of creating an anti-racism environment or school in Finland. I'm a strong believer that the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. And the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. And the only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. Because in order to treat people equally, we must treat them differently. This is where I critique the whole idea of equality. Equality could mean the way it's done in Finland is basically let's treat everyone the same. But I think with anti-racism, what anti-racism actually suggests is look more into the issue of equity. Because equity means that to treat people equally, you must treat them differently. Because you cannot treat, it's impossible to actually create a just, fair, equitable society if we only want to treat people the same. So here is how we can all become anti-racist. And it involves working through three key zones. Basically, the default zone where most of us are is where we actually deny that racism is not a problem. We avoid looking to the hard questions. We want to be comfortable. We just don't want to, it's someone else's responsibility. You know, we don't talk to others. We don't want to think about these issues. It's not our business. So we need to kind of move away from this fear issue. I think one of the biggest points in this fear zone is that we are afraid to make a mistake. A lot of people in Finland are so scared to make a mistake because of this whole concept of Finnish exceptionalism. I remember when I came to Finland and you asked some Finns, do you speak English? They would say no. And I'm like, well, you understand that. For Finns to say that they speak English means they have to speak perfect English. A lot of Finns are so invested in being perfectionist, you know, so they are so scared to make a mistake. We have to move away from that and understand that we all make mistakes in life, you know. You cannot learn without making mistakes. So to move away from the fear zone, we have to move away from the fear zone into the learning zone, where we recognize that racism is a problem and it has always been a problem. And we have to find ways to start questioning things and trying to move away from our uncomfortable feeling. We have to own that it is our responsibility to do this work. It's no one else's responsibility. It's not my friend's responsibility. It's not the headmaster's responsibility. It's not the dean's responsibility. It's our collective responsibility, which means that we have to educate ourselves. We have to do more to know more about the issues of racism. And we have to be comfortable in being vulnerable, you know, because that's the way to get away from comfort, the way from being comfortable, you know. And we also think about that's the way to move into, that's how we move into the growth zone. And in the growth zone, we are comfortable to sit with our discomfort. We promote issues of anti-racism. We talk, we lead anti-racist initiatives, you know. We make mistakes, but we don't let our mistakes bother us. We learn from our mistakes, you know. So these are some of the strategies that you can learn, you can use in terms of becoming an anti-racist teacher. Now, to close this lecture, one thing I would like to remind us is that when we think about anti-racism, we should think about a baby. You know, before a baby, when we were all born, before, now we stand, now we walk, now we run. But before that, when we were born, we learned how to feather hold our neck still. We learned how to sit. We learned how to crawl. And then when we crawled, it wasn't easy, because throughout these stages, when you learn how to sit, you'll sometimes put the baby down, the baby falls. When you put the baby to crawl, the baby falls as well. Then we also learn how to, the baby then learns how to stand. And during this process, the baby falls several times. And then when the baby learns how to stand, the baby then learns how to walk. And this is also a very difficult process, because the baby falls also several times. When the baby learns how to walk, the baby then also learns how to run. And throughout this process, the baby fails numerous times. But one thing that keeps this baby going is because the baby's desire to win is stronger than the baby's fear to fail. We have all gone through this process. That means that it is within us, it is inside us, this strong desire to win. So I actually pray that and ask you to kind of put this fear to bed and make sure that you have your fear to win or to succeed is stronger than your fear to fail, because that's the way forward. That's how we learn to be anti-racist. And it is okay to be at any level here, whether you're learning to crawl, you're learning to sit, you're learning to stand, you're learning to walk, to run. These are different stages of anti-racism. And you need to own the level, the stage where you are. And in that stage, you should always try to be better. Thank you.
Thank you, Amin, for your very insightful talk on how to become and sometimes also fall to be an anti-racist and to be something else.